If you have your Bibles, you'll want them open to James chapter 5. We are almost done with this book that we started the beginning of January. So, I want to start this morning just by rereading our passage that we heard earlier, which is a really long passage. Single verse. I'm going to read it from the English Standard Version. And so if you have it, chapter 5, verse 12. But above all, my brothers and sisters, do not swear either by heaven or by earth or by any other oath, but let your yes be yes and your no be no, so that you may not fall under condemnation. So, single sentence, but somewhat complex in that it breaks down into three clear parts. James is doing three distinct things in this verse. First, he starts with what not to do. James tells us not to swear by anything or make any sort of oath. Fairly straightforward. Second, he gives us what we should do. James tells us to let our words be truthful and reliable. Third, and finally, James offers us a warning. He says that you shouldn't make oaths and you should speak truthfully so that you may not fall under condemnation. Got it? Don't swear by stuff, speak truthfully, and you'll be fine. Sermon over. It's that easy. You guys know I like to talk way too much for that to be true. Just kidding. Mostly. except that by itself, those three points wouldn't qualify as a sermon. Even if I were to expand on each of those three points and give them 10 to 15 minutes each, it wouldn't be a sermon. It would be a moralistic self-help message. Be an honest person and your life will be better. Isn't a sermon. It's a TED Talk. And TED Talks are great. I listen to TED Talks, but they're not sermons. See, because at its core, a sermon is about one thing. It is a proclamation about God. It is about who God is and what God is doing in this world we live in. A sermon is always good news. Amen? Which means ultimately a sermon cannot be about us. It's not about how we can have a better life or be better people or make the world a better place. Did you know that? I want to say it again because it's really important. A sermon is not about how we can live a better life or how we can be better people or how we can make the world a better place. A sermon is about who God is and what God is doing. If there is anything about us in a sermon, it is only about where and how we might fit into God's world. Our place in a sermon is about how our lives make sense only in light of who God is and what God is doing. And if a sermon includes anything for us to do, it is only as an invitation to participate in God's life and work. This is a big deal because we are part of a larger church culture that has turned the sermon into some sort of motivational speech or seminar for improving our lives. We've taken a practice that is intended to be God-centered and God-exalting, bringing our lives around God and His words, and we've replaced them often, we've replaced God often with ourselves. And I want you to just consider the impact of that this morning. Where can we find truth? Now, clearly a sermon is not the only place where truth can be found. Right? Scientists help us understand the truth about how things work. And historians can help us understand the truth about our past. And sociologists can help us understand the truth about human social dynamics. But a sermon is one of the primary places where we should reasonably expect to encounter the truth about God. But what happens when you remove God from the center of a sermon and you slide human beings into God's place? It's so subtle how it happens, but the results are significant. What happens when the heart of every sermon is how people can live better, or how people can feel better, or how people can make a better world? Well, if human beings are the center of our sermons, then human beings become the reference point for truth. So that if and when we start talking about God, we're talking about God only in reference to us. And so we ask questions like, what does God want to do for us? What is God's plan for us? Why hasn't God done X, Y, or Z for us yet? And I want to show you kind of how this plays out. When we read this morning's passage, we hopefully all noticed the warning. When we heard Jeannie read it, it was so that you may not be judged. And in the ESV, it says so that you may not fall under condemnation. And so we hear a bit of what's happening there. Judged, condemnation. I don't know what you think when you hear that that phrase, but we often use it in a way of talking about our eternal status. So that if you've been condemned, you may be facing hell or some sort of eternal punishment. But it doesn't necessarily mean that. To be condemned is another way to say found guilty, or that you have been judged. So that this is what James is saying will come with certain kinds of speech. When you speak in certain kinds of way, you will fall under condemnation. What does that look like? What does that mean? Do you know if you've fallen under condemnation? But consider this. If God is the truth, and if God speaks truthfully and reliably, and if God cares about our speech because God made us to speak like him, and our speech, if it reflects what is in us, and if God cares about our speech because of how it affects the world that God has made, then what does it look like when we fall under condemnation for speaking in ways that are inconsistent with God? Well, if we read this passage as though God is the center of everything, then every time we speak dishonestly, and maybe right now you can think of a moment, think of something you've said at some point recently, that when we speak dishonestly, when we fail to keep our word, is there a promise that you've made and broken? Something you assured people you would do, but didn't? Or when we swear that we're telling the truth, James suggests that we've already fallen under condemnation. That this isn't some sort of eternal condemnation because you lied one time. This is our words actively judging us as we speak them. So that if I lie, in the moment I lie, I am showing myself in the moment of the lie to be disconnected from Jesus. I am condemning myself as living apart from Jesus, at least in the moment when I spoke the lie. Or if we speak in a way that is inconsistent with Jesus, we are publicly showing ourselves to be disconnected from him and his heart and his way, at least in the moment when we speak. And so our words condemn us. But there's another way to read this passage. Just as there are different kinds of sermons, we can read this passage with human beings at the center. And when we do, we recognize that God isn't the source of truth, but my feelings are. Or it's our culture, it's our larger culture that we're a part of that determines what is true and what is not. And it doesn't even faze us that we might be disconnected from God. See, because if I feel honest, I feel like I'm telling the truth, if I think I'm a good person, if I'm convinced that something my culture says is true, then me and God, we must be fine. And so I don't experience any condemnation. But James says, if I'm wrong, I'll be condemned. And in a human-centered way of thinking about condemnation, we begin to look for real-life consequences. And so we start to evaluate our lives and the outcomes of our decisions, and we start to say, well, I'm doing just fine. My life is working out okay. Like, I'm not experiencing any consequences. Nobody's gotten mad at me because I have lied. Or maybe I'm totally succeeding in life, and this success is built on lies. Well, if this is the case, we begin to tell ourselves that, or we convince ourselves that either I'm telling enough of the truth that I'm a mostly good person, or really the truth isn't that important. Because James says, if I'm dishonest, condemnation will fall on me. But what happens when it doesn't, in some sort of obvious consequences right away? Here's why all of this matters. Maybe you already recognize this. As a culture, the culture that we are inhabiting, the water that we're swimming in, is toxic. We are rapidly moving to a place where the truth doesn't matter at all. Honesty is going out of fashion. Keeping your word is outdated. If you talk with people who have been in the same industry or business now for 4 or 5 decades, you'll hear them talk about a time when it used to be enough to shake hands, to make an agreement, and to move forward with business together. But today we need elaborate contracts for everything. And if this is the case, if this is the direction that the water that we're swimming in is going, it's important to consider what it means for us to be connected to God, the one who is true. See, if our worship and our lives are centered around the truthful, incomparably reliable God of the Scriptures, then no matter where our culture goes, followers of Jesus will continue to seek the truth. Now, we won't be perfect in it, and we will miss the truth, and we will speak falsely. All of these things, we will not be perfect in this, but we will continue in pursuit of the God who is true and his truth. So that when we've wandered from it, we will experience the distance from Jesus and his way that will draw us to confess our sin and return and remain on the path. But there's this danger that we face. There's a danger that we would, as Christians, as followers of Jesus, start with ourselves. Start with our own concerns, so that as the larger cultural values, truthful and reliable speech less and less, Christians will accept that honesty is not all that important to God. It's not that big of a deal. We'll find ways to diminish what is true. Whether you accept that or not, our culture is facing a serious crisis of truth. I want to read for you a short excerpt from a newspaper from February 15th, 1983. So just earlier in the year before I was born. An article claimed, the president's aides used to become visibly alarmed at suggestions that he had given mangled and perhaps misleading accounts of his policies or of current events in general. That doesn't seem to happen much anymore. Indeed, the president continues to make debatable assertions of fact, but news accounts do not deal with them as extensively as they once did. In the view of White House officials, the declining news coverage mirrors a decline in interest by the general public. So, commenting on this in the 1980s, a media scholar, Neil Postman, diagnosed the problem by actually going further back and reflecting on Richard Nixon. We do well, he says, to remember that President Nixon did not begin to come undone until his lies were given a theatrical setting at the Watergate hearings. And so Postman argues that what is not amusing does not compel our attention. You hear that? What is not amusing, what doesn't amuse us or entertain us, does not attract our attention, does not compel our attention. And so in his book, Amusing Ourselves to Death, Postman lays out the case that unless we are entertained or amused by something as a population, we will largely be disinterested in it. And that would include the truth. Which is why over a number of decades, the most popular newspaper in America is, anybody know? What was that? Oh, no. I hope nobody considers that news. What would be the most popular newspaper in America? Every hotel room gets it. No. USA Today. Yeah. Why? Because it's filled with bright colors and lots of pictures. This is also why news has transformed into short sound bites given to us in argumentative ways from talking head pundits on television. This is why in our culture the sermon has been transformed into a piece of entertaining self-help. Last couple weeks, I've given you some suggestions on some sermons that you might read from John Wesley. The moment you read one of those sermons, you go, I don't know if I would go to John Wesley's church if he was the one who was preaching. They're dense and rich and theological, and they exalt God above all else, and they invite us into participating in who God is and what God is doing, but they are fundamentally God exalting. And in our culture, we've come to be trained to look for something that's a bit more applicable or relevant or immediately satisfying in our sermons. All of our sources of truth are being transformed in our culture by our lack of interest in the truth, so that God is not ultimately at the center of our lives. God and God's truth are not the desires of our heart. We don't hunger and thirst for God and his truth. Rather, God is constantly being replaced by ourselves. Our own personal growth, our own personal gratification, our own personal ambition or agendas, these are what have become most important to us. And we're happy to talk about truth and even seek the truth if it helps us in any of these areas, or if we discover anything that aligns with our pursuit of these areas, we're happy to exalt them and hold them up as truth. But really, truth is secondary. And we would ask, how do we know this is the case in our culture? And so I want to tell you a little bit of a story. Since the beginning of the 1900s, Christians in America have been part of what sociologists have recognized as this constant realignment. And I want to tell you about the kind of larger pattern that's been observed since about the 1900s, but then focus in on a more recent example. But Robert P. Jones wrote a book a few years ago that tells this story for us. And he tells the story of the American church constantly drawing lines in the sand, declaring this is us, and this is who we're against. Forming up teams, figuring out who is with us, who believes what we believe, who is orthodox enough, and making it really clear who is in and who is out. Well, throughout the last century, the church has declared one group after another as the enemy, as those who are against us. But there's this fascinating pattern that emerges. Over the last 100 years, every time the church is on the verge of losing social and political power, it realigns itself, finding new groups to partner with, to align with groups that it had previously demonized. Over and over, this pattern unfolds. In the last 25 years, we've watched one of these major realignments actually happen again. And so this is to narrow in on an example from that larger story that's taken place. So prominent and influential evangelical leaders, you might recognize some of the names, Franklin Graham, Jerry Falwell Jr., and Wayne Grudem, were all vocal and passionate in their commitment to truth. When our president had publicly lied to the American people about a sexual relationship he had had with one of his interns, they decried the loss of public morality. They asked how you could possibly trust a person to make decisions behind the scenes about world-affecting issues when you couldn't trust that person to tell the truth to your face. They said that character matters for leadership, whether that leadership is in the church or not. Well, over the last 25 years, evangelicals have lost influence socially and politically. And these very same leaders saw an opportunity in a businessman who shares none of their faith convictions to regain some of their lost power. By almost every measure, this man was substantially less moral than the president that they had previously campaigned against. Declaring truth was their core principle. And yet, even after acknowledging his constant tendency to lie, each made the case for why this businessman needed to become president. And we hear James say this morning, "Let your yes be yes." And we're reminded how often, how easy it is for our yes to not remain yes when God is not actually the center and orienting person in our lives. This is the problem. We only care about the truth if God is at the center of our lives and worship. Now, we can talk about truth forever. Truth is a great thing to lift up, but if anything else takes the place of God, anything like power or status or position or convenience, everything else will be negotiable. And I want to show you how this works, but with a really simple illustration. So most of you know that next week I will have finished my 7th year here as your pastor, which is cool and exciting and amazing. So 7 years ago, I was about 2 weeks away from graduating from seminary, and I was getting ready to move back here and to start as your pastor, and I went to one of my professors, and his name was Dr. Hardy. And he was one of my favorite professors, and he had been my spiritual director at one point, and I really respected his gentle spirit and his wisdom. He had been such an incredible guide for me through seminary. And so I went to him with a question, and he knew that I was coming back here. I had been in school. He had been my professor while I had served here as the youth pastor. And so he knew actually a lot of what we had gone through. He had helped me process some of it at various times. And one of the things that we had talked about was how hard it was to break out of this certain pattern, their cycle that we in our leadership meetings here would get stuck in. we would start lamenting in our meetings about our financial troubles, how tough the circumstances were financially. And then we would say stuff like, well, if we just reached a few more families, we wouldn't be having this conversation. We would talk about our financial difficulties, and then we would immediately start looking for solutions to bring people into the church. And I can't tell you how many times that we said out loud, it's almost embarrassing to think about how many times we would say out loud that we had to stop thinking about people as a solution to our financial problems. And we would say it again, and we would like go back to it, and we would say, no, we have to stop talking about people in this way, but we kept doing it, and we struggled with it. And so I asked Dr. Hardy this really simple pretty simple question. So how do you keep finances in proper perspective? And then he asked, well, where do finances show up on your meeting agendas? I said, the beginning, of course. I didn't know there was another option. Every meeting I'd ever been in, we talked about money first. And he goes, I have an idea for you. Why don't you move finances to the end of your agenda? I just said, I found that when I start my meetings here at the seminary, talking about God, reflecting on God, and then discussing the people who are in my care, and then the mission that we have as an organization, by the time we get to finances, they're in proper perspective. Because if you talk about money first, every time, everything else will be talked about in light of money. What starts your meeting? God, people, mission, or finances? Well, those of you who have served on the board at any point in the last 7 years know exactly that this is the change that we made, one of them, and it transformed our conversations about finances. It stopped us immediately from talking about people as an answer to our financial problems, but instead, we began talking about money as a resource, as an asset, as a thing that helped us, that help us love people and carry out the mission of God's church and is there only to serve what God has called us to do, which has been amazing. It changed the kinds of conversations we have. And I can't remember one time in the last 7 years when we talked about people as a way to fix our finances just by moving finances to the end of our agenda. But can you see what we did? We oriented our meeting agenda. We reoriented it so that everything flows out of seeking God and the love of God and his love for people. And it changes the way that we talk about finances. And this is the same thing with our lives. Is God the center of our lives? Is God the source, the starting place for our lives? Are we obsessed with him and his truth? Or are we the centers of our own lives so that truth is optional, or any truth that helps me live how I want to live is the truth that I'll hold on to? Are there more important things for us to care about? Is God the center of our lives? Are we the center of our lives? If God is, then when we start with the scriptures, there are a couple of things that we can say. That God from the very beginning is speaking what is true. That we can always count on God to speak what is true. What is true about himself, what is true about this world, what is true about us. If we want to know the truth about ourselves, friends, we don't find it in ourselves. We find it from the God who made us and speaks it to us. God is reliably truthful. And that's the other thing about him. That's what it means when James says, let your yes be yes, is when you say yes, mean it. Whatever you say, mean it and follow through. And this is the story of our God from the opening pages of Genesis, a God who wants to bless all of the things that he has made, who God who follows up and blesses all of the things that he has made, a God who offers his own son who will suffer and die so that we might be blessed, might experience the fullness of life with him. Our God speaks true words, and the things that he says he will do, he is reliable in. And when we are centered on him, when we are obsessed with him, we will pore through these pages and find story after story after story of God fulfilling his word and being faithful and true to the things that he has said. And we will hunger to be like him. Paul says, imitate God, brothers and sisters. And so we will find ourselves reading James, being reminded of who God is, that truth, the words that come from our mouths, the way that we live our lives is of essential importance. And when we are speaking anything that's not true, it's important for us to recognize that this is a moment where we have begun to wander, to draw away, to veer from the path that Jesus has us on. And he invites us back. He is, my friends, the way, the truth, and the life. If we want to know life and life abundantly, it is only found on his way and with his truth. And so what does it look like for us to walk this out? We're gonna get a chance to process this a little bit with each other. We'll break off into groups to discuss. And these are the questions I have for you. How important is truth to you and your life? The truth about God, how important is it to you and your life? And then the second would be, would you describe God as being the center of your life? And here's the great thing about some really hard questions and really vulnerable questions is that the third thing I'll ask you to do is to pray for each other. So that as we are opening our lives to one another, James tells us, confess your sins to each other and you will be healed. And so there's no shame in finding ourselves, finding that maybe we've replaced God at the center of our lives. There is only an invitation to then speak that truthfully back to him, to practice in our groups speaking truthfully to one another, and then to pray for God's grace and his blessing.